This is The Conversation. It's episode 183 with Alicia Curlin. She is a Las Vegas-based artist and director at the Barrick Museum on the campus of UNLV. All by way of Brooklyn. There's a story here that starts in New York, starts in Brooklyn in particular, and makes its way west with a lot of drama. So I'll get into that more in a bit. I'm Michael Shaw. The website for the podcast is theconversationpod.com, where you can see a variety of very cool images that I highly recommend you go check out, including Alicia's work over the years, particularly around 2010, 2011, 2012, during and in the wake of the Greater New York Show, which we talk quite a bit about, her Brooklyn studio. There are also some cool images of Vegas, including the shadow of the stratosphere over the city, her Roadrunner public sculpture project, and her Vegas house, which we talk about. So that's all there. Go check that on the website. Before I get more into the story that Alicia tells and we talk about, I wanted to point out that this podcast that you're listening to is probably, if you listen to a lot of podcasts, that is probably the smallest, most modest in audience that you listen to. And that's an odd thing to brag about. But it's all to say that you, the listener, I'm very dependent upon you, the listener, to support the show financially. And there are costs, hosting and so on, to keep the show going, time. And it's been a dry month, March, since the beginning that there has been any support. And so I wanted to take an opportunity, take a moment to remind you that your support, especially if you've not donated before, really means a lot and makes a big difference. So I'm asking you, just briefly, just give me a minute to say if you could donate to the show either via Patreon or PayPal, it would be very much appreciated. You can support the show for as little as a dollar a month. And if there are enough people donating a dollar a month, all of that adds up. If you do start at $3 a month or more, though, you will be qualified for special bonus rewards and so on. And same thing with PayPal, starting at $20 as a one-time donation. So again, if you haven't donated the show, if you would be so kind to do so, it would really make a big difference in helping keep the show going and keep it once a week, as opposed to what I had talked about before, which is moving down to once every other week. So we don't want that to happen, right? That's it. That's my pitch for now. Thank you in advance for your support. I appreciate it. So yeah, Alicia Curlin was in a show called Greater New York. It's kind of like the big biennial, but it's quintennial perhaps, because it's every 5 years. So she was in the one in 2010. She has a lot of mixed feelings about it. It gave her a lot of opportunities, but also was difficult in some ways as well, and you'll hear all about that. We actually had a follow-up call. In fact, she didn't get to address her raw feelings about that experience. So we covered that in a follow-up call, which you will hear, and I'll give you a brief intro to that as well. And on the back end, I want to tell you how I made my fight against killing the Affordable Care Act, and which right now, knock wood, is going pretty well. So we'll see how that continues. But I wanted to share that with you on the back end. That's all coming up. And I'm going to give you, like I said, a brief transition intro to the follow-up call that Alicia and I had. So without further ado, let's get into that conversation with Alicia Curlin. Thank you very much for being here. I will talk to you more in the midstream and then on the back end. And how long have you been in Vegas now?
Do you know that this week marks my 5th year, and I cannot believe that it's been that freaking long?
Yeah.
5 years in Las Vegas.
Right,
it's
right.
It's been a whirlwind.
I bet. So where do we start? Well, here's where we start, Alicia, because we talked about this before, and I hope it doesn't come across as too sensational either to you or listeners, but one of the things that you can be associated with as an artist is that you are in Greater New York, 2010 edition, right? So, and for people listening, and just to sort of catch myself up as well, Greater New York is basically the local big deal
sort of biennial type show. Although, if it clarify for me, is it every 5 years as opposed to biennials? Is that right?
Yeah, it's every 5 years. So
right.
2000, 2005, 2000.
2000 was the first.
15.
Right?
Yeah, I believe so.
Yeah. So
that was the big one. And a lot of people got galleries from that one. So
right.
There was a lot of hype. I remember the hype of like, wow, it's such a great opportunity. So many people are going to see your work.
Yeah, exactly. And it was a better time for art and the art market in 2000 than it has been
True.
In the last several
yeah.
years. Yeah. So, and just
there's that part. Yeah.
yeah. And just to further the sort of the description just for a moment, it's comparable, I guess, in a way to our sort of local show Made in LA, you know, which started, I guess, in 2012, which in that it's like, you know, it's all local people, a number of whom were previously unknown to the greater audience. And I assume that greater New York is a lot like that as well. Is that?
That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah. No one knew who I was before I was
okay.
in that show. I was really surprised I got in that show.
Right. All right. So let's talk about that. What was the arc of you getting into that show?
I believe I was recommended by, I know I was recommended by a friend. They were doing studio visits around town, and I got recommended. I got a call, and I knew it was for this show, and I was working out of my live workspace. I had sort of moved the bed out of of the bedroom, and the bed was in like the living room area next to the kitchen, and I had like a very tiny studio space, and I knew I had this important studio visit coming up. I had a few shows booked, but I remember I was so nervous that I was working really hard. I was so nervous that I almost set the place on fire by boiling some pasta and leaving the apartment, you know?
Uh-oh.
So the day before this like really important visit, and I'm working on these like paintings that I was totally just painting to send to my friend.
Which friend? The friend that who had recommended you?
No, just a different person, a writer I had met in grad school named Dorothy Albertini. Her and I shared this hobby of playing solitaire when we didn't know what else to do with our time.
Right.
Painting
Something Alicia.
Sort of lost these lost solitaire games, and I wanted to send her one as a gift. So I
right.
had these in my studio. I was like trying to produce a bunch of work for this studio visit so that, you know, clean up my apartment and everything. And of course, like the day before, like there's a bunch of smoke in the apartment, and I had to like, I don't know if this is boring, but
no, you had to air it out.
So
yeah.
It didn't smell like smoke. And then I have this, you know, big studio visit. She comes in and she really likes these paintings that I'm working on that just happened to be as a gift, you know?
Yeah.
My serious stuff wasn't really talked about. It was the stuff that I was making to send in the mail to my friend Dorothy, who also plays old-fashioned card games.
Right. How come, so Alicia, how come...
She likes the connection to failure, I guess, the discussion around failure. And
who's she?
You know, it's always the thing, if you wouldn't have asked me just right now, I wouldn't have to. One of the curator, the drawing and painting curator for the 2005, the MoMA, drawing and painting curator for the 2005 Greater New York show.
But you don't know her name?
I can't remember her name right now.
So wait.
We'll get into why I probably don't remember her name right now later in the conversation.
Oh, okay. Okay, we'll come back around to that. I see. I just found it curious that you gave a shout out to your writer friend, but then you completely glossed over the name of the person who put you on the show, essentially, right? Is that the short version of what happened?
Yeah, that's kind of what happened, because I can't remember her name right now.
Right.
And I'm trying to look it up online while I'm talking to you.
Okay.
I could tell you who recommended me, which would be a nice segue into the rest of the conversation.
Okay, I found it interesting that you mentioned the writer friend who you were making these paintings for, but you didn't give a shout-out to the person who put you in the show?
Well, the person who recommended me, you know, for the show, I figured we would end up talking about her. She's so important to me and my trajectory.
Right.
You know, so I was like kind of waiting for that to pop up. Her name is Rachel Harrison, and I worked with her for 8 years in New York in her studio.
Wow.
And then also with Green Enough Tally Gallery as well. And I learned so much from them.
What did you do for Green Enough Tally Gallery?
that was like one of my very first jobs when I moved to New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I just did a little bit of everything. The gallery was pretty small then,
mm-hmm.
Like three people. And, you know, I was like working the front desk and then helping Wade Guyton and Kelly Walker produce work and then also like selling T-shirts and, you know, running tea errands and picking up flower arrangements.
When was this?
And then,
Alicia?
This was like in 2005.
Okay. And just,
right out of undergrad, just out of my first semester at Bard, the summer, the low residency summer program. So I moved from Knoxville, Tennessee to Bard and then moved to the city directly after that and got hooked up with a job at Green and Tally. And, you know, working with Rachel was like years later. I can't remember exactly when that happened, but I had attempted to leave the gallery and then she recommended that I, you know, work with Rachel. And then that was just, that was an amazing thing. And then, you know, years later, Rachel ends up dropping my name in the hat for, you know, Greater New York.
Right. Which was, so you were,
and
in
I
the,
guess I did a good job.
Yeah.
In the studio visit, you know.
And who was the studio visit with?
It was one of the
co-curators, right. Of 2010.
It was one of the co-curators for the Greater New York show. It was like, you know, ultimately up to all three of them and Klaus. But yeah, it was just a really intimate studio visit at my house, my apartment.
That's a quite a career arc. So you were working at, were you working sort of as a gallery assistant, artist liaison, kind of both? At Green Off Tolly?
Yeah, a little bit of both. Like whatever, you know, whatever they needed, basically, whatever Carol needed. And of course I held other jobs, other assistant jobs. When you first move to the city, you just have to take whatever you can get.
Sure.
And I was always open to just working. I've always worked.
Yeah.
And they really helped, you know, Carol helped me out. And then of course getting introduced to Rachel Harrison was a huge, huge thing for me.
Mm-hmm.
She taught at Bard, as well, so there was that connection.
Right. So did you know her then before?
I learned so much from her.
Yeah.
I knew her from like a drive-by studio visit at Bard.
What's a drive-by studio visit?
It's like super fast. Super fast studio visit. I still have the notebook. It says backwards, beware of your distractions in the notebook. And that's kind of that's what she left me with.
And what does that mean?
Because I was just breaking open my work.
Right.
Your first year of grad school, hopefully you're open to experimenting. And I had, who knows what I had up in my studio at the time. And Rachel was just probably picking up on the fact that I'm easily distracted. And she wrote that in my notebook. And that kind of, that's the kind of thing that'll stick with you. And, you know, other than that, that was the studio visit I had with her at Bard. It was really quick, like a 20-minute one, which is why I called it a drive-by.
Right. 20 minutes, not too bad, actually. I mean, you could go a lot, one could go a lot shorter even, believe it or not.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So let's get to the sort of overarching subtext here. And I guess that is, how much of that do you feel like was being in the right place at the right time? You know, or just being in New York and being around all these opportunities and, you know, sort of it not being ultimately that big a deal, you know, that you were in with this gallery and that you were working for Rachel Harrison.
Oh, I think I was open to pretty much anything at that time in my life. And, you know, the people who supported me, I it's not like I had a ton of people supporting me, but a few people.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes maybe it only takes one or two people. That's what I tell students when I teach, you know, someone who really supports your work. And then also being in the right place, like Brooklyn at the right time.
Yeah.
Obviously.
Sure.
And maybe the pieces I was like working on at that time really applied to what resonated in the curators' minds. But yeah, I think it's kind of being open. And when I have young students ask me, like, should I do this internship or should I say yes to this show, I always just tell them maybe in the beginning you should say yes to everything. And then once you have more to choose from, then
right.
You can be a little bit more selective because you never know what it's going to lead to.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think what you're talking about applies especially in New York, where there are all those different things that are going on, where you can have situations where you have to, where you get to decide whether you, or and I should say, where there are all these opportunities. You know what I mean? Even though these students are asking these questions in Vegas, I can't imagine that they have the variety of potential situations that you did.
Yeah, it's a little different out here. You know, I've really learned to appreciate all those opportunities that I had in New York, and you know, like choosing to go out there was a good thing.
Yeah. And here, going back to your studio visit with the one of the three curators, and were they all associated with MoMA or PS1 MoMA, that kind of thing?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that it was in that you had made your apartment a live work, and so did you make the living room essentially into your studio?
No, I was painting with oil and kind of wanted to make a mess, you know. And
right.
I had a dog and a cat.
Oh, uh huh.
And a boyfriend at the time, and I wanted to be able to shut the door, so the one room that could actually close besides the bathroom
right.
was my studio. High ceilings, but only about 7 feet by 7 feet.
Wow. Okay. That's impressive. Yeah. That sounds like a New York apartment. Was that and that was in Brooklyn?
That was in Brooklyn.
Right.
Yeah.
So here's what I'm getting to, because this is something I for what it's worth, I don't want to take people too far from you, but I would like to briefly mention that I was in New York for a number of years, and I had turned my living room into a studio for a period. And the reason I mention that is because I think when people came over to do studio visits, it was tricky to have them not be distracted by that context or, you know, that situation. And I just wonder if you were able to, how you navigate around that, or if maybe because it was New York, you know, at a recent enough time where apartments were expensive, even small ones, and that this was not really that unusual.
Yeah, she, you know, it was Connie Butler who came to the studio.
Got it.
She didn't seem fazed by it. She was a little annoyed that there was a long walk from the subway. But,
that is, wait a second.
You know,
don't gloss over that. That is classic, because I have had conversations before, and I specifically remember one. I think it was with what is his name? But it's an artist in Brooklyn, and I remember him saying something like, "Yeah, there's some people that complain about the walk from the subway." So that is the person who complains about it. That's hilarious.
It is, and it was kind of a terrible commute. You know, it was pretty far. Like when it was snowy outside, I really dreaded having to walk to the train. It was kind of over by the Navy Yard.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't. I kind of expected it. You know.
Sure. Right.
Yeah. She was great though, and I just felt like it was a great opportunity. One funny thing that happened while she was there, though, my cat, I guess, was picking up on my either anxiety or being excited. And she had never done this before and never did it again. She climbed the door jamb to my bedroom studio and put her claws out and slid down, like screeching chalk on, you know, nails on a chalkboard,
right.
Screech down.
Right.
And that was like the end of the studio visit. She was like, "All right, I think I've seen enough." And I thought, you know, like, if I don't get this show, it's because Annie, my cat, did that to me, you know, like it's her
right.
fault.
Right. Yeah. Well,
but
as
just, you know, of course.
Yeah. Go ahead.
It would have been better if I had my own studio.
Yeah. But despite that, it was enough, as it turned out.
Yeah. It was fine, you know.
And so you were
one thing I learned in school was that like studio visits are happening to the person visiting as much as they are happening to the artist. So I had just come, I kind of like come off of that and realized like, well, I can kind of steer this, you know.
What made you have that sense that it was as much happening to the person doing the visit? I mean, had you had specific experiences yourself where you felt like, oh, this is happening to me?
Well, yeah, you know, someone comes in and maybe the conversation goes in the wrong direction and you really want them to not give you advice, but maybe respond to like what's hanging.
Yeah.
Even from colleagues and other artists,
mm-hmm.
you can say like, actually, I don't want you to give me advice.
Right.
Can you tell me what the work is actually doing? You know?
Yeah.
So when someone starts commenting on your dish towels, you can steer it away.
Yeah.
You know?
Right. Right. So she gave you, despite your cat's complaints, she included you in the show, Greater New York 2010. And what was that like? How many people were in it, first of all?
It was really, really unbelievable, I have to say. I didn't feel worthy being next to some of the artists, and I was a little freaked out by the press and the filming and, like, you know, how much attention certain artists were getting.
Sorry, you cut out for just a second there. How much attention certain artists were getting and
then, like, we're not getting any attention. Like, I've always shied away from getting my photo taken.
Mm-hmm.
I'd rather, like, a photo of my work be published.
Mm-hmm.
And there was, like, an email sent out that, like, you know, Vanity Fair is going to be doing a photo shoot. And I was like, oh, God. Like, I don't want to be part of that. That sounds horrible.
Yeah.
And, you know, of me, like, standing in front of my work or something, that sounds really bad.
Yeah,
and,
right.
Of course, I show up. And there's, like, three artists. I can't even remember, of course. It's like, this is how it doesn't really stick with me that much. But I saw that three artists were getting their photos taken and no one else was getting any press. And then I realized that, like, oh, wait, I was doing the thing where you say, like, don't look at me. Wait, why aren't you looking at me?
Right. That's awesome.
You know, so
yeah.
The social anxiety of being in that show was, you know, I really felt that.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really exciting. And being next to artists like Lucy Raven, and DeVille Cohen, and, you know, just being a part of it was cool.
Yeah.
And I didn't realize how many people would actually see the work. You know, people would travel, you know, from out of town to go to the major, you know, it's a major museum. So.
Right.
It was nice. I got a lot of opportunities and studio visits from that, mm-hmm. which led to other things as well.
Yeah. Before we get on to some of those, what was the reception like? You mentioned, you know, that it had a lot of attention on it, but do you want to get into any specifics about the reception of the show?
The reception of the show?
The show / your work, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I've tried to forget some of the bad press.
So I shouldn't remind you of it, in other words.
You know, where my name, you know, you look to see if your name is mentioned, and you know, I sort of, like, have purposefully forgotten that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it was fairly well received, and I also had a show up at Real Fine Arts at the time, like a solo show,
mm-hmm.
Which I was actually more excited about because I could like really do like a lot more in that space versus just my corner in Greater New York. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, I was working really hard on, it was a busy time. I was working really hard on that. I was working a day job, and then I had this MoMA PS1 show. You know, it was a busy time, but it was also super cool because then when I started getting calls for studio visits, I didn't have to invite people to my house. I could invite them to the solo show.
Yeah. Right. So you had some painting, some solitaire paintings in Greater New York. Is that right?
I had some solitaire paintings and then some photos of cookies that I had taken
mm-hmm.
in my upstate studio when I was living upstate before that. So.
Right. And the reason I ask
cool.
is
cool. I got to produce and frame those works.
And what was the work then that was in the gallery at the same time?
It was all solitaire works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the show was called Cat and Mouse. And I had also photographed a pet shop parrot falling asleep and had put those up as well. So it was like solitaire paintings and these photos of sleepy parrots.
Right. Got it. So yeah. There was a lot of solitaire playing paintings that were around and in people's consciousness as far as you, the artist at that time.
Yeah, it was what I was working on, and, you know, I when Connie responded positively to the solitaire paintings. You know, the show, I can't remember how much time, but I had more time to prepare for the show. I just continued working in that series, and I was really enjoying it because, you know, there's like endless compositions to pull from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you play solitaire, you're like throwing the cards down on your, you know, on the floor, and they land in certain ways, and then you play the game, and then sometimes you can't win the game, you know, it just stops, and what you're left with is amount of content to pull from. So I just kept making those paintings.
And what was then the impact of this being in the show as far as your work going forward?
I think really what happened was I got a critic's pick in Art Forum talking about the work.
For the Greater New York or for a gallery that. Show? I'm sorry, for a gallery show?
For the gallery show.
And what was the gallery again?
Real Fine Arts.
Real Fine Arts. Where were they, and or do they still exist?
Yeah, they're in Brooklyn. They still exist. They do art fairs now. They're like, you know, two artists run. It's an artist run space, and they have like great programming, and they're doing really well.
What neighborhood are they in?
So I had this in Brooklyn, in Greenpoint.
In Greenpoint, got it. Okay, continue.
Yeah, and. Okay, so what happened was I got the Art Forum review. I'm in Greater New York. I have a solo show at Real Fine Arts. And then I get a studio visit with Zach Fuhr.
Right.
And he came in and was, like, really responding to the paintings. And that was more so than the... I mean, the Greater New York led to that, but more so than Greater New York, that was like a big break for me because I had a lot of medical debt and I was like severely broke. And
yeah.
I sold a lot of paintings out of that show and was able to get out of that debt.
You mean the Zach Fuhr show or the Real Fine Art show?
Zach Fuhr coming in and buying the work from
the studio.
Real Fine Arts.
Oh,
which later then led to like a solo there.
Right, right. Before
thank goodness I didn't have the studio in my house, you know. It was like already up on the wall and presented.
Yeah. That's a really important point.
You know.
Can we segue for a second here and can I ask you about the medical debt? What kind of medical bills did you have?
Lyme disease.
Wow.
I was living in Rosendale, and you know the tick-borne illness that is like so prevalent in that area. I had gotten that without any insurance, and of course, you know, racked up a lot of medical bills from hospitals because of it.
Where's Rosendale?
It's like an hour and a half away from the city near Kingston.
Okay, is that where you were? Does that relation to Bard or no?
It's near Bard. I really loved the area, and it's near Bard. I lived up there in a house part time. I was living up there, and then sort of commuting down to New York and staying in this tiny room and closet in Williamsburg part time, working in the city, and then going upstate and making art for a while. But whenever I had the studio visit, I had already moved back down to the city. But I was sick because I was living up there, and that's where the ticks live. You know.
Right. Right. Wow.
Yeah.
And had you been gambling then to not have health insurance, or it was just kind of a financial reality kind of thing?
It was a reality. I didn't have it, you know.
Right, right. Got it. That's rough.
Just kind of unlucky, you know?
Yeah. It's kind of a weird counterpoint to the whole art thing.
I've been very lucky that I got out of it. You know, I got out of the debt because I was able to sell my work. So.
Yeah, right. So Zach Fuhr came to your studio. He really responded to it, as you said, and he bought all the work out of the Real Fine Art Show.
Yeah, he didn't come to the studio. He came to the actual gallery.
Oh, I'm sorry. Right.
Work out of there.
Right.
Yeah, and he had like, you know, collectors buy, you know, the photo series out of Greater New York.
Wow.
It was really an amazing, overwhelming day.
Yeah. I bet. What did it do for your ego?
I ended up. What's that?
I said, what did it do for your ego?
Oh my God. I was a little shocked. You know, I had suddenly made more money than I had ever made in a year working my day jobs.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I just went to work. You know, I kept working, but I cut down my hours, you know, my day job, and I got a studio, which is really wonderful. I got
Where?
A studio in Sunset Park, and I just started making paintings.
Mm-hmm.
I was super, super busy.
Right.
So, you know, I didn't go out. I didn't do anything except for make work in my studio. So it definitely lit a fire, you know.
And what went after that you had that day, as you mentioned, as you described it was that day that was pretty overwhelming. Was it shortly after that that you ended whatever day jobs you had at that time?
I cut my hours. You know, I didn't completely quit, but I did cut down my hours and focus more on making art.
Right. So you still...
You know, I kind of mm-hmm. look back at that time, and it should have... I look back at that time and, you know, like, what an amazing opportunity, but also it was kind of lonely for me. And I don't want to sound annoying by complaining, like, I just sold a bunch of work and then I get a studio and all this stuff, but, you know, you're talking to me right now from my office in Las Vegas working at a museum.
Mm-hmm.
I do really well when I have a job and an interface and a structure and a schedule.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was working at the studio, I'd be in the studio like 12 hours a day. And I thought, if I died, the only person who would know would be the guy who sold me the like pecans from the bodega on the way to my studio. Cause mm-hmm. I would see him like, you know, in the morning before I went to the studio and then in
right.
the afternoon
right.
when I would, or the evening when I would come back.
Yeah.
You know, so it was like just a really specific time. And, I just find that if I do have a job and I am like either teaching or giving back in some way, I do a lot better.
Was the boyfriend not in the picture at the time?
Yeah, I think it was like one of those moments where it was a long breakup.
Mm.
So, you know, mm-hmm. that could have had something to do with it too. But yeah, he was gone and
right.
I had my little dog. We'd go to the studio and I'd work all day and then head home.
Yeah. Well, you had the dog. That's not total loneliness, is it?
Yeah, studio assistant. Yeah, yeah,
yeah, yeah.
No, and it was totally good too. But, you know, I needed to reassess the idea that like to be a professional artist, you had to do it full time.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't really work for my brain. I needed something else.
Yeah.
To teach it for a while, I was like commuting to Boston to teach a form study course. You know, and that. That was a good way to keep myself sane.
Yeah.
Know?
Well, what then, how would you like to address the period from where we are now in the story to your leaving New York? I mean, maybe you can just direct us to the turning point in that evolution.
Totally, yeah.
Yeah.
And when we scheduled this interview, I was thinking it would be all about Vegas and what I do here at the museum. It's really what's present on my mind.
Are you remiss of, like, that we're not talking more about Vegas right now?
No, not at all.
Okay,
no,
good.
I'm feeling like I can't remember names and a timeline exactly.
That's okay.
You know, for the fast, it was such a whirlwind. I had something like 9 solo shows from end of 2000, like 2010, you know, through my time, basically, I guess it would be 2010 through 2013. I had all these solo shows. It was a busy time.
Yeah.
It was a whirlwind. And
mm-hmm.
I had this show with Zach, and my paintings didn't sell. And then I knew that, like, he probably wasn't going to take me on as a permanent artist. And I had some credit card debt. And so I needed to get out of New York. And I was also like working at this frame shop. It was a really crazy time. And I saw this application pop up for a residency, artist in residency in Vegas. And it paid 10 grand for 8 weeks. And I had never been to the desert, never been to Vegas. And I applied. I didn't have any connection.
Mm-hmm.
Like no one recommended me or anything.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually got it. And I got it, I think, because of those shows, those major shows.
Right.
You know, that registered with the people selecting the artist in residence out here. And so I came in March of 2012, and within a couple days, I started thinking about, like, oh no, maybe I don't want to go back to Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm. Right, right.
You know.
So let's rewind for a second, because
sure.
What I'm curious how on one hand you were having this boom period, and then on the other you found yourself struggling, and you did address it, but in the way that you mentioned that you had the show, you after him and his collectors having bought your work, you know, out of the gallery and out of Greater New York, that he. You eventually had a solo show with him that did not sell, is what you said. But but you did say that you were working all the time, and so I am left to guess, you know, before you actually tell me what happened, that you were investing maybe a little more in your work financially than ended up bearing fruit, and that's why you ended up getting into debt as well.
Yeah. I was just sort of aiming for this solo, and he was selling things out of my studio before the show, and things were going really well. And, you know, I had a studio, and I was, like, getting stretcher bars built.
Mm-hmm.
Because the ones I had sort of built before were warping, and, you know, I think I was just expecting that this show would probably do pretty well, but I ended up showing things other than solitaire games, and you know, of course, the only two things that sold out of the show were the solitaire cards, which kind of fucked my brain up a little bit.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Of course, this is something.
And
that
so I was like, I got to get out of here. I got to get out of New York. I can't do this.
Right, lesser New York.
And I applied to the residency and got it.
Yeah, you need to get out of lesser New York is basically what you needed, right?
Yeah.
If you would pardon the pun. Yeah. So you just illustrated. I just want to. Without running away from it yet, you just illustrated one of the reasons that artists stick to what works, you know. And there's so many conversations that I've had with people about being able to experiment, and I mean, in other words, I haven't had that many people lately on the show that I've talked to who have careers that have a very identifiable brand, you know, it feels like. And maybe I have, and we just haven't talked about it in this way, but there's this sort of almost fictional or sort of abstract notion of an artist who keeps making the same thing over and over again because it works, and that's what people expect from them, you know. And unfortunately, with what happened to you, you sort of your career or your collectors or what, however you want to phrase it, sort of confirmed that stereotype.
Yeah. And some people can do that. And I think that if you paint stripes your whole life, that's a totally valid way of spending your time, you know, but it's not who I am.
Well, do you have some people in mind when you use that sort of abstract idea of an artist, or, you know, do you know people? Did you have peers in New York who were that?
Yeah, I know people who put their head down and they like treat
and they
the
make
studio
stripes?
Like a 9-to-5. You know,
right.
They go in there and they work on their project and they make minor adjustments and they learn from those minor adjustments and they just kind of keep plugging along.
Right,
and
so they're sticking, as far as you're concerned, without naming any names, they're sticking with the formula that works.
Yeah. And I think that that's okay. Like, I'm not judging it. It's just, you know, I think I would kind of go bonkers if the only thing I got to show, you know, was like just my solitaire paintings.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, I think just to play devil's advocate for a second, I don't think it's nice of you to be diplomatic and say that, you know, I don't judge that. It's fine. You know, do whatever works, but I don't feel like I've talked to anybody who would actually, and it's hard to imagine talking to somebody who would admit, yeah, that's what I do. You know, I keep doing the same thing because it sells, because it works. I think people
yeah,
who
that's,
do
that's
that,
one thing.
I think
yeah.
people who do that probably have to do a lot of rationalizing too, because, you know, yeah, it's, hey, I'd rather be doing this than, you know, not making a living from my work. So I'm just going to keep doing what sells.
Yeah. And it's a case by case basis. I know artists
sure.
who do that because, like, they have, you know, partners who are sick, you know,
wow.
and they need to sell this work so that they can pay the medical bills. They're like the breadwinners for the family. And then I know people who genuinely like make grid paintings, mm-hmm. and they are sort of pushing at the edges and, you know, really engaged with the work, and maybe it doesn't actually even sell, but they make the same thing their whole life, you know?
Wow.
I remember one of my teachers in undergrad, he had sort of worn the floor down under the door to his studio. He had been there for so long, and he was just making these sort of gummy worm abstractions, and I don't think he was selling the work, but that's what he did. He did that every single day, some version of the gummy worm abstraction until
right.
There was a path worn under his door in the concrete.
Wow.
From
walking,
logging in those hours 9 to 5. So.
Right. Well, let's take a philosophical look at this. I would very much like your insights into the psychology of sticking with your brand, whether it's a brand that sells or does not sell. You know, so we're talking about people who are on one hand making a living from their formula, right? Either because
sure.
it's what's comfortable and or because they have a partner who they need to support for big medical bills, as you said, right? Or you have, as mm-hmm. you described your former teacher, somebody who's making work that doesn't sell, but they're doing the same thing. So why do you think, not that you ever asked him or no, but just if you were to imagine getting in his head, why is he doing the same paintings over and over, essentially, or continuing to do them year after year when there's no real market for them? And, you know, and meanwhile, what kind of, you know, intellectual or artist satisfaction would he be able to get from being so repetitive?
You know, it's a case by case basis. And you know, one of the things that,
mm-hmm.
I'm going to answer you, but it'll be roundabout. I kind of have to find what
well,
I
this
need
is
to
the
say
case.
Here. Is that okay?
But this is the case. This is the case. It's this guy. Let's start with him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay. Leland, all right. So he's worn his studio down.
Do you
want to
mention
his
last name? Maybe he will appreciate the plug.
Whitney Leland.
Whitney
he
Leland.
He taught painting uh-huh. one and watercolor and oil painting at the University of Tennessee in Knoxville.
Okay. Right.
I try not to make like sweeping judgments.
Sure. Sure.
You know, because I've met people who like I know that they're what they work on is like deeply involved. It's not just like they're trying to appease a dealer. You know.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. I think you're raising a really good point, which is in addition to it being a case by case basis, it's also really a question of perception. You know. We can, on an abstract level, we being, you know, the art community, the art world, whatever you want to call it, we can talk about, you know, these people, quote unquote, who make these same things over and over again to, you know, because there's a market for it and because they would not want to risk losing that market. But when you get down into a specific scenario, it's never that simple, I think, is what you're, the subtext of what you're saying.
Yeah, and, you know, like, if you actually talk to the artists, they might have some, you know, deep background to why they make the work that they do.
Yeah, right.
You know, maybe it marks time.
Right, right.
Know?
So getting back to you then.
I like looking, you know, and I'm continuing to make solitaire paintings, but I don't really want to show them.
Oh, interesting.
Does that mean I'm, like, stuck in a rut and, like, doing the same thing?
right. Well, can we just go back
art,
to...
Making art's like a long thing. Like, you do it your whole life, and, you know...
Some people do.
It can change. You can revisit series or, like, you know, stick with it.
Yeah.
Working.
Yeah, well, what was... But what I wanted to go back to was you had the show where you had a... Was it a few solitaire paintings, and then the rest was a new body or something like that?
The show with Zach?
Yeah.
Yeah, it was like, okay, what did I do? I did like I had two solitaire paintings. I had some vulture paintings, and I had some carrot on stick paintings with these like carrots floating in a mucky sort of ground.
Right, right.
And I was thinking a lot about like the player and the artist and being alone in the studio and sort of involving the viewer in these games. So to me, it made perfect sense, you know.
Sure. And when
to go from solitaire to carrots and vultures.
And when the show, other than the solitaire paintings, didn't sell, was part of you thinking that you needed to sort of gather yourself and figure out what the next step was? Did it have a certain blow to it, or was it more like, you know, no, I'm committed to this new direction and I don't care that they didn't sell?
I didn't want to care, which is why I signed up for the residency. You know, I recognized that it was sort of getting into my head a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
About that. And I also realized that, wow, I cannot rely on the art market for a steady income.
Right.
And,
right.
You know, so like, here, let's try some other things. And honestly, to tell you that, can I reveal?
Please.
Why leaving New York was a good thing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So like Tennessee has this amazing artist in residence program where they bring people different than the main professors, mostly women, from New York or LA.
Mm-hmm.
And those people were like highly influential to me. And so was my main professor, Michael Brocky. And when I saw them and heard about their lives of living in New York and doing this teaching, and I saw how you know, influential my main teacher, Michael Brocky, was towards me. I was a math person, and choosing art was not easy. My family didn't support it.
Mm.
Like a class with him and with these artists in residence showed me that, you know, art making was more than what it looked like, and it was a worthwhile way to spend your life. So I always knew that going into art, I kind of like looked up to these artists in residence, and I thought, you know, wouldn't it be amazing to be able to do that, to give back and teach in that way? So for me, it was never like about, oh, getting the big show. It was like the ultimate goal was to be able to do these residencies. So
mm-hmm.
when I left New York, and I got this residency, it felt more like more of a success than Greater New York.
Oh, wow. That's
when I actually got mm-hmm. here and was able to teach.
Mm-hmm.
It felt great. You know, my teacher had passed away, and for me, it was like more important to do the residency,
right,
and talk to the grads, talk to the undergrads. I felt
right.
like, oh wow, I've made it. You know, I was 30 years old 5 years ago.
Yeah.
But does that make sense? You know, like, so this, I'm kind of uncomfortable with the talk about, like, you know, should I have continued to make solitaire paintings? Was I, you know, about this like branding, because for me, making art was a little, you know, making art and choosing to do art was like a different choice.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, it kind of does. I think it's good to go into the discomfort though, whatever that is, you know, if you're going to admit that talking about a certain thing is makes you uncomfortable, we have to ask, well, why does it make you uncomfortable? Right. If you want to go down that route. But what I was doing is I was speculating that you had this show and there was a certain amount of disappointment, if not for you, for your dealer. Right. That's just the reality of it. And so what I was asking was, did that situation make you question what your decisions were? And it sounds like it didn't, basically. But that's basically what I was trying to get at. So despite...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Despite whatever intentions or objectives you had as an artist, you know, those kinds of things, especially when you get all this attention and these shows in a short period of time, you know, that's going to be part of the mix, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I certainly, like, I was going to do whatever I wanted to do, you know?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, right.
Like, I'm not going to, like, just continue. Yeah. I was interested in making these carrot paintings and these measuring tape paintings, so that's what I was going to do, and that's what I did. And
right, right.
I was pretty confident with that.
Yeah,
you
yeah.
know? And oh, well, oops, crap, I didn't sell out my show.
Mm-hmm.
Let's reassess what Alicia needs to do now. So,
right.
And honestly, the way Zach kind of did the whole transaction, you know, if you're going to support a young artist, maybe buying up all their work and, you know, throwing them into the secondary market and, going about it this way, that maybe isn't the best way.
Yeah.
Too, if you are really intending to support someone long term,
right?
That's maybe not the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And I had a positive working experience with him, but like when I look back on that, if you know, someone young comes to me and says like, "Hey, should I do this?" I might give them advice from my experience.
Sure.
No.
Right.
Yeah. Keep some of your inventory. Like, slow it down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know.
Yeah. Right. Well, that's really interesting, going back to your perspective on teaching and getting the residency in Vegas, and that was making it for you. That's pretty heartening, especially after all that you went through prior to that. And so did you actually, you said earlier, when I was in that residency, I got it and it was time to go back to New York. I was like, do I want to go back? So did you go back?
Oh my God, my bike was stolen off the gate in front of my apartment, right? My beloved bike. In the same week, right, this happened. My bike was stolen, and then I got a call and emails that my studio rent was getting raised.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that, like, I was like, oh shit, I'm going to finish this residency, and I'm going to go back to New York, and I'm not going to be able to afford my studio, and I'm living in one room, like a one room in like a house broken up into apartments that,
right.
You know, I just was like, and my bike was stolen.
what kind of bike was it? It sounds like a fancy bike.
No, it was just like my little, it was a short bike. I'm 5'2" and I, you know, I felt really comfortable on it. It was heavy and, you know, just like a little old vintage bike.
Right.
And, you know, it was just kind of like, and my bike was stolen. My studio rent was doubled and my bike was stolen.
Mm-hmm.
And, like, the next week, I like saw this like beautiful house in Las Vegas, and you know that Las Vegas was hit by the housing crisis pretty bad.
Yeah.
And I just was like, I wonder how much houses cost out here. And it was like a 3-bedroom with like what I could see as a perfect studio space for like $74,000.
Wow. And
turquoise with like a cactus garden, and I was like, what am I doing in New York?
Yeah.
And, you know, they were talking, I was having a great time at the residency, and, you know, as I continued, you know, it looked like maybe there was going to be a teaching position opening up, so it was really unexpected. I had never been here before. I didn't come to the residency thinking that I wanted to leave New York, but I ultimately did. I went back to pack up my stuff, go to a wedding, visit a friend, and then see my family, and then I drove out west with a bunch of like plastic tubs filled with my crap. I had gotten rid of everything. And luckily I didn't have a huge inventory of paintings, but what paintings I did have left, I gave to friends. And I moved out to Las Vegas.
Right.
Yeah.
And when did the baby come in to the picture?
If you would have asked me, you know, 5 years ago, if I would be driving a big, ugly Mercury Grand Marquis, have a mortgage, and have a kid.
Yeah.
And be directing a museum, I would have thought you were really crazy. but she's 16 months old, and you know, one of my creative outlets out here is like doing baby pattern clash outfits for her. So.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I'm sorry to be so kind of personal / you
this
know.
This is what you do. I've listened to the podcast. I know.
It's not always what always what I do, but this particular, you call for this kind of questioning. I think.
I know.
Right?
Go for it.
What do you think my question is going to be?
Oh, I don't know. Go ahead.
Well, it has to do with the baby. So, is there a father?
That's how things happen. Yes, John Stoltzini is an artist, and he used to teach here at the university, and we collaborated on a big project that was totally different than anything I had ever done before. It was a public art project, and we made 13-foot roadrunners that ended up going into like a government rotunda. Then they were outside, and now one is at the park that I take my daughter to.
Mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
He's like a welder and really good at figuring out problems. And we made the Roadrunners together, and then we made a baby. After that, so.
Right. So all that is the reason I was curious is because, as you said a little while ago, if I had asked you, would you be doing all these things in 5 years, you'd say I was crazy. But the partnering up, as it were, and having a kid in that short a time is pretty fast too.
Yeah. Well, and buying my first house and. It helped because I got a really great gig at the university.
Yeah.
So insurance and salary and the whole thing, that helps. And
sure.
The cost of living out here is really, really low.
Right. So you're the interim director at the museum on the campus of UNLV, right? The short version of it.
Yeah.
Is it possible they'll hire you as the permanent director, or how does that work?
Yeah. They're trying to open up probably a specific line for that position, and then there'll be a national search, and I'll apply for that. If I don't get the main director job, I'll have a space in my old position, which is collection manager and doing
mm-hmm.
everything else.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like there will always be a little spot for me at the museum.
Right. Got it.
And we've had a really good year,
Uh-huh. What defines a really good year at the museum?
Well, we're in our 50th year, and for Vegas, that's a long time.
Sure.
We used to be like a natural history museum, so I get funny calls about tortoises and spiders and snakes, and people still come in looking for lizards,
Yeah.
before that, it was the gym, so there's a lot of history there, but I applied for the official name change of the museum, and it's been showing art since the 80s, but since 2012, when I was hired to kind of help with the transition into the College of Fine Arts, we've become the principal art venue for Vegas, and I got it approved by the provost, which is no easy task, to add of art to the end of the name.
Right. What was it before?
And it was just the UNLV Marjorie Barrick Museum. Before that, UNLV Marjorie Barrick Museum of Natural History.
I see. Right.
Before that, UNLV Museum,
Right.
So.
Right. Got it.
At this name change officially happened, we got voted best museum, best art space by several publications. So it's been a really good year. We're growing our collection, and there's a new dean who's awesome, and we've been engaging with students in ways that hadn't been done before.
And what
Which
is
for me is like my favorite part of the job.
Yeah, well, I was going to ask you what the job entails. I mean, what are some of the main functions that you have, or what are the main things you do as the interim director?
I am the single like full-time person here, so obviously like when you take on any art job, you do everything.
Right.
But the main thing would be like the financial side of it, the administrative side of it. Scheduling tours, working with staff on creating content for tours,
mm-hmm.
putting together a board,
mm-hmm.
fundraising, setting an exhibition calendar,
right.
trying to figure out ways we can engage the community, all that
right.
stuff is really fun to me. And I feel like I'm making a difference by doing that.
Yeah, that's great. And where do you suppose the abilities to do the less intuitive parts of the job as far as fundraising and administrative type work? I know you probably did some of that, working at the gallery and other jobs, but I mean, I assume a lot of that you've been learning. Am I right?
Yeah, when you're like making art in New York, you have to hold down all these other freelance jobs and you never know when you're going to use those skills that you learn from those jobs later in life. Like I worked this weird job at Rockefeller Center for the person who co-founded CNN and founded the Food Network.
Wow.
As like an office person. And then I worked at the gallery, and then assisting Rachel, I learned so much about like conservation and,
mm-hmm.
and mounting big museum shows and, just a ton from that. And then, inventorying estates, was another thing that I did. And, I learned how to handle all kinds of different work from that. I worked at a frame shop briefly, which I learned more from that than anything else, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm scrappy, so when I don't know how to do something, I'll figure it out, you know, because mm-hmm. it all sort of serves the greater need to make this. I want this place to succeed so that it can provide something to the community, because there's a lot of culture in Las Vegas,
mm-hmm.
but we are a big part of that, and I know we are, and I know people really want it. It's, you know, the locals who are here and even the people who visit, it's not all about the Strip.
Sure. Right.
And,
right.
You know, they're wanting to see culture too. So I know that, like, if I know that I need money to make that happen, to get CCSD school buses in, I want to find a way to raise the funds to do that, because if my daughter's growing up in Las Vegas, wouldn't it be nice if the public schools brought all the third graders to the museum to see art in person? So,
right.
So that when I ask college students, have you ever been to a museum before? More than one or two raises their hands.
Yeah.
You know,
right. Is
which is like what happened when I first got here.
And are the tours that take place at the museum, is that kind of the biggest public interaction that you have? Because I presume you're not like doing studio visits as part of your job or that kind of thing.
I am.
You are.
I'm approved to serve on committees. Like, I went to this graduate student studio the other week, and it was so awesome to talk to her about her work and learn about her work. And I left feeling like, wow, you know, there's some great art being made in Vegas. So, yeah, I do studio visits. And
then you can recommend the work to the board, that kind of thing?
Not really for the grad students, but you never know. Like, who knows, maybe... maybe
right.
in a few short years, right?
Okay, yeah, I got a little ahead of myself, didn't I? Yeah, yeah, right. And what about your identity, you know, being the director of the museum and being an artist? Is that, are you, I'm going to guess, if you don't mind, that you don't really care that much whether people perceive you as an artist or, you know, this person who runs the museum or what have you.
Well, at first it was kind of a brain fuck, actually.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
Where, like, you know, like, who am I? I just had a baby. I'm directing this, you know, my supervisor left, and then suddenly I'm directing this museum. Like, what does this mean? You know, it is awkward sometimes. Like, the current show, there's like a Ryan Wallace painting hanging in there, and I had worked with him prior as an artist before. So it's like this weird full circle that now his paintings are showing in the museum that I'm running.
Yeah.
So for me, I make a choice to see it as a great connection. But when it first happened, I was a little like, you know, what does this mean? You know, what am I, like, I thought about, you know, like, I haven't really been working on my website, you know, should I stop making art for a little bit? And I kind of made a pact with myself. Okay, I'm a new mom. I'm directing this museum. It's enough work, and it's very creative. And, like, maybe I'll call this, you know, part of my studio right now. And as soon as I told myself I would stop making work, of course, I started making more interesting work.
Right. Right.
You know.
So you tricked yourself into making better work.
I did. Yeah. Yeah. I needed that. But maybe you could help define what it means to do all of these things at once, because, yeah, It's a weird shift, but
yeah,
you know, like, right. I'm moderating a panel that's coming through, and that feels like I'm speaking as an artist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if that makes sense. Even though I am speaking as the director.
What's the panel going to be on?
I'm using. Oh, it's Sharon Loudon's book tour.
Oh,
artist,
yes,
culture producer.
Right, of course, yeah. Sharon Loudon.
Like Justin Favela is going to be on the panel, and he was just on your podcast.
That's right. Yeah. And Sharon was on the podcast a while back as well.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Small world, right?
In Vegas, it might be.
It's a small world.
Yeah. Right. Right. Well, is there anything that you feel like we have untouched or overtouched?
I think that's probably good. I mean, do you have any other questions about the museum, living in Vegas, art in Vegas?
Yeah, we could certainly go in that direction, couldn't we? Well, why don't you tell me what it's like living in Vegas? Yeah, that's an interesting thing for sure.
Well, there's more real estate. You have the opportunity of working outside all the time. It's a really freaking weird city that you have these giant casinos sitting next to each other with unrelated themes, you know, and in each casino, 24 hours a day, this stuff is happening. You've got the desert with, you know, there's this bowl of Las Vegas and then the desert, which is absolutely beautiful and it's a context of its own.
Right.
You know, I came out here and I felt like there was not a drop of irony coming from the students or from the people in the arts, which I found really refreshing.
Mm-hmm. You were happy to have an irony-free zone that you were living in?
Totally.
In a sense?
Yeah. Huh. Uh-huh. Yeah. Like, you know, no one just nods in agreement when you talk about something. Like, you have to kind of break it open because it's a little dispersed and wide open out here.
Right.
And not everybody agrees on what art making is. So.
Yeah.
I started writing a lot about it and sending postcards to friends either in Vegas or outside. And it was like, that was a cool way for me to work through it. But, Yeah.
Well, you did mention that you bought this house and you described it a little bit, but I was trying to ask you then what kind of neighborhood is it in that you live?
I live on the edge of a really fancy neighborhood called Paradise Palms. My neighborhood is not fancy at all. It's a scrappy mid-mod neighborhood. But there is some really great architecture. And this house that I live in is like a two-bedroom. And it used to have a water feature in the back with like lava rock and this spitting fountain that we took down, a hot tub that we took out. Like, who needs a hot tub when it's 115 degrees outside?
Uh-huh.
You know,
yeah.
I have a pool and a dishwasher and a washer and dryer, which I never thought I would have in my life.
Right.
But the house, you know, it was painted pink and on the inside and had carpet going up the walls. And
oh, my God. Wow.
It was, you know, just terrible.
Yeah.
And needed a lot of work, and it still does.
I see. Got it. Right.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
They had, like, planted annual grass over the sidewalk to sell the house, so it looked all nice and clean. But then, of course, you know, the grass died because it was on top of the sidewalk, and, you know, there's a lot of work to do.
Got it.
But it's cool. You know, I love it.
Mm-hmm.
I love that I can have my weird sculptures out in the front yard. And,
right.
You know, my neighbors are all strange, and, you know, there's packs of chihuahuas that run around.
Oh,
bark at you when you're
wild?
In the front yard. You know,
they're undomesticated. Are they domesticated?
They don't act. They don't act domesticated.
Wow, that's fascinating.
Yeah, but it's it's you know, pretty fun, and you know, I've got a lot of projects going on, and that's like, you know, trying to maintain the house and keep the museum afloat and.
Well, what about coming from New York and being in Vegas as far as the commuter lifestyle, that everything is spread out and, you know, and you're in the car most of the time, you know, not unlike California, that kind of thing. Is that something that you got over quickly?
Oh, God. You know, I can't tell you how many times my car got towed in Brooklyn to the Navy Yard.
Right.
That's not an experience that I would wish on my worst enemy. So, yeah, it's, like, nice to be able to park really easily and drive around. But I do miss – it's not a pedestrian city at all.
Right.
And I do miss walking around, and I do miss, like, on your way home, on your built-in commute, on your way home, you could pick up whatever you need.
Yeah.
You know, it's just a different lifestyle for sure.
Yeah, and a lot of strip malls.
It is car culture.
Yeah. And your visuals from work to home and back are from home to work and back are a lot of strip malls, from what I recall.
Yeah, there's a lot of strip malls, and you know, I pass by the strip kind of close to the strip on the way to the university. Like, you know, we can like look down the street that we're off of and see, you know, the Aria and Louis Vuitton and the Hard Rock and all that up there. But yeah, it's totally strip mall city.
Yeah.
With a few cool, like, you know, pieces of neon left over on these streets. But,
right.
But yeah, you know, you've got your mid-century houses and mm-hmm. cool pockets, and then you've got your gated communities. It's a huge city.
Yeah, right. I didn't see that much of it. That's kind of why I'm trying to help get your help painting a little more full picture. So.
Yeah, you've got your, like, you know, huge, like, gated communities with stucco box houses. You know, all of them look the same, and they're, you know, 3 feet apart. That, to me, is like a, you know, you can't figure out which way to turn because all the houses look the same. That's like my worst nightmare.
Do you have friends or colleagues who live there?
Yeah, a lot of people live in that stuff. They love it. But for me, it's not really my thing.
Doesn't, yeah.
You know, I don't care if there's like homeless people walking in my front yard or whatever. I'd rather have that than
right. That's the New York
in
you.
Gated community.
That's the New Yorker in you, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, that is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I think we've covered a fair amount. I mean, we could certainly go on about Vegas, but I think we gave it a fair shake. You feel okay?
Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you,
yeah,
Alicia.
Yeah,
I appreciate
good.
It. Yeah. Okay, so that was our originally recording. Before we get to the follow-up, I wanted to just let you know, this was something that Alicia told me via email, that as far as the story of who recommended her for Greater New York, it was actually apparently not Rachel Harrison, as Alicia wrote to me. Rather, Alicia was in a show, pop-up show, in the sculptor Judy Pfaff studio in Brooklyn, and Connie Butler, that curator who we talked about, who did the studio visit for Greater New York, saw Alicia's piece there. And that's how the story was written. Maybe Rachel Harrison was later involved as far as getting a, you know, backing her up or what have you. But it was actually Connie Butler who saw the work. That's how Alicia remembers it. So before we move on to the follow-up conversation, just letting you know that I included a little bit of hold music before I got on with Alicia the second time for a little flavor. So enjoy that. Enjoy the rest of the conversation. Talk to you more on the back end.
895-3641. Looking to show your support or want to engage with Southern Nevada?
Hello?
Hello, Alicia.
Hi.
Hi.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you. It sounded like you had some, I don't know if anger is the right word, maybe resentment towards the experience or the show itself. How would you put it?
You know, the show, and this isn't me just trying to be like diplomatic. The show truly gave me opportunities.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm like completely grateful for that because it brought me to Vegas. I was able to be an artist in residence here at
right.
UNLV, which was like a major part of the trajectory and decision making and into like actually making that leap into making art and doing it and majoring in it and going to grad school, all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So getting that show is like a major, you know, spot on my resume and gave me credibility to be selected for the artist in residence program out here.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope this makes it into the podcast. I'm totally grateful for that.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you talk to me in person, you would find out that, like, you know, I love art. I love talking about art. I'm, you know, very passionate about it. I really like supporting other artists. And really the least interesting part of my history, despite it being the most interesting to some, is the Greater New York show.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Right.
You know, and
how would you explain why that is?
I just, these big survey shows of emerging artists or regional shows.
Right.
You know, I just feel like they're kind of stupid.
Yeah.
You know, and the hype around it is stupid, and it's not really about the artist, and it's not about the art, you know, in a lot of ways.
Right.
I mean, of course, the exposure and you know, if you make that choice to show in galleries and museums, you lose control. And I think part of, like, you have to lose control.
So what was it? So that's a great,
work,
yeah, know? Yeah, that's a great realization and a very sort of key statement. So what was it? And maybe you sort of talked about this kind of without intending to when we spoke about it the first time, but what was it about being out of control maybe that comes to mind most when you look back on that? I mean, I think you did eventually talk about it as far as being really hot and then all of a sudden, you know, the next day, sort of randomly, X had been selling and then you showed Y and only X was still, you know what I mean?
I mean, like, just the statement of you saying, like, you know, your work was really hot, like, just to me just makes my skin crawl, you know, which is all wrapped up in this,
right.
You know, the market and all that. It just, I'm like, oh my God, like, that's embarrassing. I just blushed, you know?
Yeah.
And when you talked to me earlier, you asked me this question, like, what did that do to your ego? And I was like, oh my God, like, what is he getting at? You know?
Yeah.
I don't think he knows where I'm coming from. And it really kind of threw me for a loop.
I'm glad you mentioned that question, because you did say, just for listeners, to let them sort of in on our post recording email conversation, you said, that question threw me for a loop. And if I had been asked it again, I would have said, what exactly do you mean by that? So now I get a chance to clarify.
Yeah, like, I thought maybe you were being mean or something, or like...
Oh, you totally misunderstood. Like, you know, yeah, you misunderstood.
Do you ask, like, guys that, or is it just because I'm a woman? Or, like, do you ask everybody that, or is it because I was being kind of vulnerable? Is that why you asked me that?
Like, well, I certainly hope that it's not a gender-specific question. if I were only to ask
moment,
that to women...
In the moment,
that,
I thought that. Afterwards,
yeah,
I realized
right,
no.
Right. Yeah, no. I think you're misunderstanding the intention of that question. The question is not, wow, you were like, this invisible woman artist, and all of a sudden you became a star. What did that do
Ooh,
to you?
Barf, yeah.
Yeah, it was more, so the intention of the question, what did it do to your ego, is just for anybody who goes into the spotlight quickly like that. And that's the thing that I was sort of trying to describe about that show when I was characterizing it. And I was asking you if you agreed that one of the qualities of it, which is also kind of the case with the Made in LA biennial, is there are some people who get into the show who are really not familiar to the market. You know, there are many people who are very familiar to the market. And then there are some people who are unfamiliar to the market and to the sort of the well-traveled circuit of the gallery, you know, and museum scene. And
sure.
So that's
yeah.
One angle of it. But I guess maybe more, I should more clearly describe what the question, what did that do to your ego, mean? What is that about? It's kind of about imagining, sympathizing with somebody who's in that situation and being lauded publicly, you know, just that process. I mean, it's as simple as that. It's not a gender thing, and it's not, ideally, it's not any of those other sort of qualifiers.
I know. My answer now would be that it really fucked me up.
Yeah. How did it fuck
really
you up?
It fucked me up.
How did it fuck
I
you up?
I hated it. And I got a lot of weird shit from my peers. You know, and it's
okay, well,
kind
see,
of
that's,
lonely and
right.
And like,
see,
no
that's
one wants to hear that. This is
yeah,
my point. Like,
yeah, that's
everybody
it.
Wants to be in that show. No one wants to hear someone whine about, wow, I got in this great show and like,
oh,
you know, it's
right.
been hard for my studio. Like,
right.
it's been hard for me to make work and like kind
right.
of piece that apart. But then, you know, no one wants to hear that, right?
Yeah. Well, see, that's a really.
I guess I was just not good at it. You know, I wasn't good. I wasn't ready. I didn't want it.
Right.
You know, I didn't want that. I just wanted people to write about my work and talk to me about my work. And the second I got in that show, people stopped talking to me about my work.
Do you think that both for you specifically and generally for any artist sort of thrust into the spotlight, that there is going to be that phenomena of peers being envious and resentful?
I think it's a, yeah, it's a I don't think I was even in the spotlight, honestly. Like, there were so many people in that show, and, like, I just had my little corner, and
right.
I was in the project space at Zach's gallery. You know, I don't want to, like, give the impression that I was, like, really a big hit at the moment. You know, like,
yeah.
Anybody really knows who I am, but
right.
Yeah, you know, I think, you know, my relationship with my, you know, totally not a great relationship with my then boyfriend, you know, it was there, I could sense some jealousy there. And I have my good friends who were really kind to me during that time, but a lot of people would say things, you know, socially, and I'm really sensitive, you know, and I'm not afraid to say it, and I don't think it's a bad thing, but they would say something like, so how'd you get the show?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, rather than like, I really like what you did with that line in that painting, you know, which is maybe what we
right.
would have talked
yeah.
about before.
Yeah,
but how'd
yeah,
you
yeah.
get that show?
Right.
Kind of implying that I didn't deserve it, or, you know, it just, it's kind of a gross conversation, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, yeah. the subtext or the sort of, yeah, the subtext slash larger vision that you are describing in addressing this dynamic and the multiple mm-hmm. dynamics that we're talking about is especially the way you described yourself as being very supportive of other artists, which I already have a pretty strong sense of. And I think that's a great thing, is the idealism, which we are still as an art community so far from figuring out, which is this more socialistic type platform, as opposed to this pyramidal structure of the art,
mm-hmm.
not only the art market, but still the, you know, other parts of the art world as well. And I guess by what you're doing and by promoting other people, you are contributing to that more socialistic model as best as you can. But does that resonate with you?
It does resonate. And, you know, it's really, you know, I've noticed that when people pass through Las Vegas, or I talk to some of my peers out here, that if you're from a major city, you know, like New York or LA or Berlin, like, people's ears perk up a little bit more, as if, you know, that artist may seem like a little bit more important or something like that, which I totally don't agree with. I've been to people's studios out here who've been making work for, you know, 60 years, and they may not be relevant to someone living in New York curating a certain show or whatnot. But, like, to me, I think that, you know, like, I just did this yesterday. I was so interested in their work, and it was just this absolutely wonderful experience. And of course, I, you know, then again today for my job has brought me to listening and hearing about, you know, a well-known curator's work and an artist's work. And, you know, I feel like I'm very open, you know,
mm-hmm.
to those things.
Yeah.
I try to, like, be open to hearing about people's work and, like, where they're coming from, and knowing that, you know, it's a long road and that people have many different chapters. And, you know,
yeah.
I don't want to be too cheesy about it, but you can interject here. I could keep going and going.
No, I think what you're saying about the many chapters, that actually is something that Kaisa Johnson, who's the current episode of about to put out part two of the two-part episode with her, but she talks about in the second part she actually made this. We talked a lot about the political situation and her activism, you know, since the election.
Mm-hmm.
And when I asked her about artists getting involved politically or in terms of being active, she said artists should make really good activists. Because, and she went on to describe how artists are persevere. They work for a really long time. It's the long game.
Mm-hmm.
And these
mm-hmm.
are the kinds of qualities that are directly translatable to making change politically. So that point about, you know, the long game that you're describing with some of these people in Vegas, you know, I think is, for me, a really important one as somebody who has not been in Greater New York or Mid LA. You know what I mean? And and the other thing I want to say too about what you were saying is that it's just really, I think it's really hard to find this happy medium between the sort of ego-driven, sort of weird, and as you put it, gross elements of the more of the market type world, which some of us, despite that, are drawn to because of the work in it, to this more anonymous, out of beyond the radar type of situation of work and curating and so on. It's kind of like when you talk about, and I don't know what it's maybe like on a larger platform, when you talk about some of these more obscure people, if people give you kind of a reaction of enthusiasm or more of, oh, who's that? You know what I mean? So all that to say that it would be really nice if there was sort of a happy medium kind of between those two places, but it kind of feels like you're either in the scene, in the market, or you're sort of working in this more obscure place.
Yeah, the market's in, but it's not a binary.
It's not place, a binary, you know? True.
No, and as soon as you recognize and can name the players, you know, the train's already gone, you know?
right.
And there'll always be people doing interesting things. I mean, Las Vegas is, you know, there is no... You know, when I came out here, I just felt so like it was so wide open that you could do things that you didn't have to follow the model that someone else had created.
Right.
And I still feel like, you know, it's up to artists to kind of make that happen. So
yeah,
it's been a huge learning experience. And I mean, yeah, you know, I don't know if I will continue to make paintings now that I'm directing this museum.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm a new mom. I mean, I'm the first to admit, I mean, what an identity crisis, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I care deeply about art and artists, and I was taught by someone who really, I'm speaking about Michael Brocky in Knoxville, Tennessee, who maybe wasn't known, like you probably didn't know who he was and, you know, hadn't had a show in a major museum or gallery in forever.
Mm-hmm.
But he taught Wade Guyton and Josh Smith and myself, and brought through like all these artists in residence, and, you know, really changed my life.
Yeah.
So for me, that was valuable. You know,
that's
and
great.
I don't give a shit if he was like in some big show. I know he was, you know, or like part of some big gallery. It was really... That was really, to me, his life's work. And of course, he was like still making art.
Well, for what it's worth, I really actually, in theory, if not in practice, I deeply value those types of teachers that you're talking about, as opposed to the ones who may very well be good teachers, professors, but are there primarily, if not exclusively, because they have star power and they attract students.
Mm-hmm.
I prefer like the teacher that you had that you're talking about, you know, that is just a great, solid teacher and maybe people outside of that particular community don't know about.
Yeah, but, you know, you start like connecting the dots and you see, you know, an amazing reach, you
mm-hmm,
know.
Mm-hmm, right.
You know, and the legacy continues with that artist in residence program that he started. They're doing a great job down there. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, so I'm glad you gave me a chance to sort of fit that in there. I don't know if I've clarified it. Obviously, like it's probably going to be constantly changing in my mind. And I'm still processing, you know, much of this. So just think, and you know what, you're so generous. You give people so much time and you give them a chance to have their voice heard.
Yeah.
Congratulations on what you're doing.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thanks.
Obviously you care deeply about the arts and like continuing this conversation. And I love the model about how you ask for people to give recommendations and that it, you know, you can connect the dots and see the trail and see how small the world actually is, this art world.
Right. Well, does it feel...
You know, you ask, I give you recommendations. You're like, oh, they've already been on the podcast.
Only one. But do you feel like, though, I mean, it's, to me, I think there is this weird perception that shifts from, oh, it's such a small world, you know, when you talk about such and such teacher or artist or whatever, and you know, you mention them to somebody and they go, oh yeah, I used to with so and so. But then mm-hmm. when you talk about these artists in Vegas, you know, especially the ones who've been working for a long time, then the art world and the world does not seem so small. You know, it seems like, oh, there are all these different nooks and crannies, all these different communities that I'm unfamiliar with. I kind of prefer that world. I don't prefer the one where we all know each other, you know, and several of which we hate, you know.
It's great when you find something that you've never seen before and you're suddenly inspired. And like, I can probably mark on my hands, you know, like 20 times when I had this moment where like, oh my gosh, that makes me want to go into the studio, or like, I've never thought about things that way. And that's really powerful, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's so cool to meet new people who are making things that you've never seen before.
Yeah.
Never talked about before. And that's why it's important to kind of get out of the bubble.
Get out of
LA, get out of New York, and explore some of these spots.
Right. Well, yeah. Do you feel like you have had a nice follow-up and you've been able to sort of make peace with any loose ends?
Yeah, I mean, I'm still embarrassed at how much I bombed the original recording. I'm hoping you can do your editing magic. But I feel better. You know, I just obviously needed to process it. I mean, how surprising that 7 years ago is still that raw, you know?
Yeah, yeah, right.
I didn't want to let Justin Favela down. You know, he recommended me.
Right. No, he did not let you down, or you did not let him down, actually. So, yeah. Well, thank you again, Alicia. It was good to do a follow up and catch up a little more.
Awesome. I'm sure we'll be crossing paths again.
I hope so. You know. Yeah. Great. I appreciate it.
Okay. Bye bye.
Bye bye.
Thank you so much again to Alicia. And if you're worried that I was too mean to her or that she seemed too uncomfortable, just let me reassure you that we're all good. We've emailed and talked since, and we're all good, and we're on each other's sides. So in case you have any concern, we are on each other's sides. We are moving forward in harmony, and it was great talking to her, and I think that second follow-up call really clarified some things in a helpful way. So I hope you agree. Again, the website for the podcast is theconversationpod.com, and I'm going to tell you about my experience trying to defend the Affordable Care Act or repel the replacement, as it's known, in a second. But first, I just wanted to make one final request. It's a weird one, and that is that if you would like me to appear on other podcasts, all you need to do is recommend me. So if you listen to other podcasts, if there's one that you listen to that you think I might be a good fit for, this could be a great way to grow the show. And I've gotten a couple of people to pony up. One of them was a listener, Eric Cellerier, who recommended me to a show called The Big Listen. And another, more creatively perhaps, was Maggie Nowinski, who wrote to WTF Podcast with Mark Maron, thinking that maybe he would give me a shout out. I don't think that's going to happen, but I appreciate the ambition in it. Thank you, Maggie, and thank you, Eric, for doing so. So if you guys would like to join them, it would be greatly appreciated. Again, it's a great potential way for new listeners to find the show by my going on another podcast. So recommend me to other podcasts. That would be much appreciated. You can hear me in a different light, potentially, which I would appreciate that opportunity. All right, so here's what happened. This was, I guess it was beginning of this week, maybe Monday. I had been lax on my activism, my being active in terms of what's going on in the world and the government. So I got an email from the Center for American Progress with an action toolkit, and if you go to the toolkit, it takes you to a spreadsheet where you can reach out to Republicans who were apparently on the fence about the overturning the Affordable Care Act with this Trump Care. And it lists in the spreadsheet, you can social media them, you can call them, etc. And so I thought, okay, well, I'm just going to start at the top. So it's a woman who is a congresswoman in New York. I can't remember her name. And I said, all right, I'm going to call her. I'm going to call that office. So I called the aide or whomever picked up, stern sounding guy. And I asked, do you know if Congress
woman so-and-so is going to be voting for this replacement healthcare or not. And he said she hasn't made up her mind yet. She's still doing some research, essentially. And I was like, well, we're a day away from the vote. When do you think that's going to happen? You know, and we went back and forth for a moment. And then I stupidly admitted that, well, as a California constituent, I think, and before I could even finish, he was like, I'm sorry, I have to leave the line free for constituents, something to that effect. And then before I could even say anything else, he basically hung up on me. And meanwhile, my blood pressure went through the roof, and I was like, I'm not sure I can keep making these calls. So I went back to the spreadsheet. I tweeted at all of the like 12 or so people on that list, which only took me a few minutes. And then I said, all right, I'm going to call the California Republicans who are supposedly on the fence about which way they're voting. So I called the office of Dana Rohrabacher, who's an Orange County representative. And then I called Daryl Issa. I can't remember if he's like the Valley or what part of California he represents. He's pretty notorious Republican guy. But in any case, this time I pretend to be a constituent for both of them. And, so a short conversation. I said, I'm a constituent, and I think that the congressman should vote no very firmly. And I gave my name, and I said, the first person asked, what's your address? And I said, I'm sorry, I don't want to give my address. And so that was that. So I sort of contributed. And as you heard, the plan to vote for this new thing got bumped, basically, through a mutiny among Republicans. So yay for us for now. And I will leave it at that for now. I hope you stay active. I hope you enjoy the episode. Hope you have a good week. And I will talk to you, presumably, if you support the show, next week. Ciao for now.